This week on the show, Conan returns, but to what audience? The gap goes gorilla. Does Hulu Plus add enough? And the battle over government cable. Right here on This Week in Media, number 209. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. This is Alex Lindsay, and we have a killer lineup today. Coming in from local online news, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. And you're back from Florida. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But yep. you're back from... Did they actually launch?
They didn't, but they kept us around for like an extra 4 days.
Awesome.
And it was really cool. So we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Did you get any space ice cream?
I did. They gave me some space ice cream as part of my goodie bag.
That is the best. All right.
It's
anyway,
it's
also coming in, we have Brady Brim DeForest. Brady, what are you doing now?
So I had this question, Alex. I'm actually in the middle of launching an incubator here in Los Angeles.
Oh, very good. So we'll and it's an incubator for media, new media?
Media and technology companies.
Oh, very cool. And coming in from New York, Brian Stelter from the New York Times. Hey, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you writing about this week?
Well, it's the calm after the storm, I think. After Conan O'Brien premiered, after Keith Olbermann got back on the air, after all these, you know, loose ends got tied up in the TV world.
Yeah, it was definitely a busy week last week. Have you guys seen, this is going to be a little bit of a non sequitur, have you seen I think it's the American Express ad for Conan?
I did. I loved that ad.
Oh my gosh. That is the funniest Conan spot ever. Like, I mean, of all the things that he's done, for some reason,
out of the film, yeah,
it was like this little. It's a 1 minute. If you haven't seen it, folks, if you're listening, there's this thing about Conan, building his own, like the curtains or whatever for his show, like going to India and researching everything and working with people and really doing it himself and everything else. And you just have to see it. The visuals are just great. They must have. I mean, they just went all out.
It was
so well done. Anyway, so jumping in, we've got a lot of news. Jumping into the news of things here, the music business. The question is really revolving around EMI, but it really is a question about, you know, what's happening in the music industry. So of course, EMI was bought for £3.5 million. It's probably near $6 million. What is it? $6 million, something in that range, $5 or $6 million US. And you know, they, you know, it's not really clear how they plan to turn this around. And one of the things they try to do, of course, is just come in and, you know, and this is all, of course, according to the Telegraph. And they, you know, tried to figure out how to tighten everything up. And so they, you know, consolidate your assets, streamline your business through cost cutting and restructuring. Of course, the problem is that these are all artists. And, you know, they've started to lose a lot of the artists. They're trying to figure out, you know, where they go next. They actually have become... in the short term, they become profitable, but at what cost, I think, is really the question. And, you know, it's just, you know, this, the, you know, the, it, what it continues to point to, and the next story is going to talk about the other direction, but what this continues to point to is this kind of slide that's going on in the music industry that just doesn't seem like there's any way to get, you know, to get out of this. So, Brian, how does a label today become successful? Can it become successful?
Well, you know, there are artists that have broken out in the past couple of years, Lady Gaga probably being the most prominent one, that have proven that there are ways still for labels to make money, and there are ways for labels to thrive. I thought the Telegraph reporter, you know, had it right on the head when he said, you know, they're making product, quote, for an audience that doesn't know what it wants until it hears it. I've got to think, you know, that's always been true, but now there are so many more headwinds that these labels face. And I have to think that artists more and more will, not all of them, but an increasing number, will try to go out on their own without a label.
Right. Now, and that's actually a great question. That brings up a next question, which is, Lon, what does a label actually bring to an artist these days? I mean, why would an artist want to go to a label?
Well, I think labels still remain really good marketers, right? You know, they are able to get especially new artists, out into the marketplace very effectively. And Lady Gaga, a great example, and many others as well. But there comes a point, though, where the artist may not need the label anymore. And I think we're seeing that now with digital. Before digital, you couldn't get your – you couldn't manufacture enough CDs on your own. Or if you did, you couldn't really build a mass audience. But that's all changed. And I think the labels are going to go through a lot of what the news media is going through right now, that people don't need them as much as they used to be able to get themselves out to a mass audience. And I think that's what the biggest challenge they're facing here is. And maybe they have to go back to their core competency, which is marketing artists.
I mean, I think that's the issue is that, Brian, do you think that the artists are almost in an invisible fence where they think that they still need the labels, but they actually could do a lot of this on their own?
I think that's true for some, but I look at the band Queen, for instance, that just left EMI, but they didn't leave to go out on their own. They left to go, they signed an agreement with Universal Music Group instead to release albums with Universal. You know, for some reason, you know, there's many artists that still believe that they need the backing of a label, whether it's for marketing or other purposes. I have to think maybe it's the up-and-coming, you know, artists.
Right.
Maybe it's the ones that don't yet have a label that would be the ones that might try to, you know, avoid getting roped in ever.
And some of them have gotten signed that way. I mean, one of my favorite artists in the recent times, Zia V. And, you know, she got signed to a smaller label by basically putting stuff up on YouTube. You know, and so, and the question is, of course, and the label, I'm sure, has done a lot. And I think the argument is that the label still manages, you know, gets airplay, gets, you know, some airplay, gets tour dates, gets you on, like if you're on a label, you get to open for larger acts, that'll get you a lot of exposure. So those are the kind of things that a label can still do. But it is a question of whether that's going to make sense. And if we look at this next story with Taylor Swift, you know, she sold a million copies in the first week, 769,000 units. This is all according to billboard.com. 769,000 units, 278,000 digital downloads of Speak Now. So she has, you know, and this is not a big label. This is Big Machine Records, and you know, they, you know, now what they say. I think it's Scott Borchetta or Borchetta. It says we're, you know, it's really 5 years in the making to get to this point. You know, they really spent a lot of time on it. Now here's the thing: is that they really. You know, what you have here is what may be the next generation of artists that can actually make this work. You have someone who is smart, someone who shows up in a lot of different places, someone who uses social media, someone who really engages with the fans, someone who is also very talented. But, you know, the question is whether you in the same way that the labels didn't know how to make money before, the question is really is can bands who are just pure talent without a lot of, you know, business sense or at least some discipline, can they, you know, succeed? Lon, do you think that this is the tightening of this industry where bands are really going to have to, you know, before we used to be able to write business plans on a napkin, and now you really want a real solid business plan with real solid numbers. Is that what labels or even bands need to start considering when they're doing what they're doing?
I think so, for sure. And again, comes back to perhaps the strength of the label that they can push this kind of volume out to a mass audience that that artists perhaps on their own can't do. I'll tell you, I was just looking at this Taylor Swift story. Part of me thinks that there's still something nice about walking into a store and buying a physical object, and especially as we get closer to the holidays, right?
You know, I thought that, but I bought one. I bought a Mark Cohen CD at like Starbucks, you know, because I was like, yeah. Oh, this looks really good, and I bought it, and all I did was I just ripped it, and then I was like,
yeah.
Oh, I'm never doing that again.
And you toss it to the side. You know, when you look at the holidays, though, you know, I show up at you know, with the family, they start doing gifts and stuff. To hand out like 12 envelopes of Amazon or iTunes gift certificates, this doesn't have that same allure of boxes under the tree, perhaps. So maybe there's some of that tangible product still being attractive to people, and that there might be some hope for the labels in that regard, perhaps. But it also speaks to how easily people are getting these CDs onto their digital devices, which is encouraging for us as content producers.
Brian, do you think that this is something that is a trend, like they could actually look at the success here and reproduce it, or do you think this is just a blip in an otherwise downward, you know,
I personally don't still buy CDs. I'm not attracted to that physical holding of it the way you guys are describing, although maybe it'll come. It's a retro thing, right?
Yeah, it's like, right. People buying albums.
But I was really Right, exactly. Not, but you know, not a lot of people do. Enough do to make it worthwhile to make a few albums. But I was struck in this story about Taylor having the head of the record label say that you have to be prepared for a mainstream media moment. The way that Kanye West interrupted Taylor last year at the Video Music Awards, he said you have to, you know, when people come and check you out, you better have something, otherwise they're going to click away. You know, you better be ready for that moment where you're in the sun, when you're in the spotlight.
Well, and I think that's a great point, and I think that that's also a great – that's something for all the media areas. When you see people putting stuff up on YouTube, when you see people putting stuff up on you know, anywhere, on Vimeo, all these things, not just music but their own videos, and suddenly they get millions of views, you got to know when you're going to put something up. I mean, it's one thing to put up a wedding and do and have it whatever, but if you're going to put something up that you really worked on, you got to know what you're going to do next. I mean, I have a lot of friends who put something up online. They just wanted to put it up and see if people watched it, but they had no idea what they would do next. And suddenly they had all this attention and they were unable to, you know, really capitalize on it in the way they could have if they had kind of a business plan. It almost seems like if you want to do that, exactly what he's saying here, you got to know what is your goal for step 3, 4, 5, if this is successful. If it's not, then you go back to the drawing board. But if it is, you got to know where you're going to go, you know, in this new industry, because it does happen like lightning. It's not manufactured the way it used to be. So our next story is, I feel like I keep on being the bearer of bad news. But the next story here is everything you need to know about the MGM bankruptcy. This is from the Wall Street Journal. A couple things by the numbers. $5 billion in the amount the investor consortium, including Sony, Comcast, and Providence Equity Partners, and TPG paid for MGM. $5 billion, the amount secured debt the creditors are owed, but they're not going to get any money back. They're just going to get the movie studio, if that. And the problem is, of course, the movie studio is only worth $1.25 billion in June. 59% drop in cash flow. They're going to have a larger board. If they have a film over $150 million, they need to get a majority of the directors to approve it if the film isn't included with, quote-unquote, reasonable specificity. You know, you think that if you're going to spend $150 million, all I'm saying is you might want to have reasonable specificity. So anyway, still their number one film, it's hard, you know, when your big hit is so long ago, is inflation-adjusted gross of Gone with the Wind, $1.6 billion. So they started off well. Now, here's the question for you, Brady. Is the movie industry becoming the next music industry? Is it in this throw of, is this the beginning of these companies starting to kind of start to unwind?
You know, Alex, I think it's a fabulous question. The reality is that a movie takes a lot more capital to finance than an album. And so when you're looking at, you know, films like Avatar, you know, which cost $500 million to make with its, you know, marketing spend included, and then returns, you know, a significant multiplier of that budget. I think that it's really, you know, there's a difference in terms of magnitude of scale. MGM, like you said, started off really well, but you know, you have to build a studio on a library of content, and sure, you know, the legacy content, the Jim library is, you know, certainly a big asset, but you have to continue to make hits. The movie business today is a hits business. If you look at what Ryan Kavanaugh is doing over at Relativity, you know, he's actually, he and his team have put in kind of an algorithmic formula to predict the success of you know, film productions, and I think that if you can do that, then you have, you know, a chance of kind of avoiding the rabbit hole of the hits business and you know, releasing consistently profitable films.
Well, here's the question though about that is I mean, because that's always the talk. I mean, we can predict whether this movie's going to be successful. We can do all those other things, but the question is does that end up as a consumer? And this is a question for you, Ron. Does that end up kind of getting us to like the lowest common denominator? You know, the gruel that all of us are willing to watch. I mean, that's kind of what got us into TV in some ways. I mean, and I used to work at Lucasfilm, where the idea of focus groups was looked to be gentle, very looked down on. You know, it's kind of like, we're making the movie, we're the reason we're up here is that we're making the movie that we're going to make. You know, and people will either show up or they won't. And so far, regardless of who complains or whatever, enough people show up to make a lot of money. You know, so the thing is that there is a question of, you know, but there's never been a concern where I used to work about whether people would like it or not. You know, I mean, it wasn't except for the people who were working, you know, the person who was writing it. So the question is does this, do you get into this thing where, you know, that you spend too much time trying to do focus groups, too much time trying to do calculations, and end up with a product that just isn't very exciting, but, you know, profitable?
I think they might have to do some of that. You know, they're a big operation, and if you need to make your profit from a mass audience, then you probably do need to churn out some generic junk that you know will sell. I mean, you could look at just about any business in America and see how that works. And the other thing that might be, they need me to focus on perhaps is looking at perhaps the audience is getting more concise in their interests. And a great example is an MGM property, actually, the Stargate SG-1 television series, which they canceled on the air and had a great, a 10 or 11 year run. And they then did a number of direct-to-DVD videos. They had some spin-off series also that came out of that as well. But those were pretty successful because they have a very dedicated fan base, and they were able to forego the expense of having to distribute it over cable networks and all the other intricacies that involve with that, and just directly publish it. And, you know, perhaps there's some hope for coming up with some really good stuff that might not hit a huge audience, but digital gives you a tremendous leg up in the overhead of distribution. So you can forego the movie theater, you could forego everything else, and just sell a DVD or sell a download.
Well, I know that, you know, what we're focused on for next year, I mean, we're about to go into, we've been doing lots of service providing, and we're about to go into doing a lot of our own stuff next year. And we're really focused on the, you know, lots of singles, but lots of, like, you know, two to three minute pieces, you know, for the web, and then see which ones take traction. If they don't, if they don't take traction, then we don't move on. You know, we do eight little shorts, and then if they're not successful, if they don't look like they're going to go, you know, we're going to move on to another subject matter. You know, rather than taking those big risks. Brian, where does MGM go from here? Where do the studios go from here?
This conversation makes me realize how many why there's so many sequels in the theaters.
That's right.
the only MGM movie that worked at all was Tub Time Machine, and I'm not entirely sure how you'd make a sequel out of that, but I'm sure they're already working on that.
Right.
It's a time machine to the future instead of the past. I don't know. I'm not sure where they go from here. I've got to think that there's a number of movie studios that are performing very successfully. I don't see parallels to the music industry writ large, because I think both television and the movie industry have learned lessons from music. But, you know, I think maybe what we're going to see, as we're seeing in television, where the smallest of cable channels are starting to have bigger problems, maybe we'll have the same thing in the movie industry, where the smallest of the studios also crumble.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I think what we've seen already is this no man's land. We've talked about this before on the show, that used to be probably $5 to $20 million is now really $2 to $50 or $60 million. Where if you make something for less than $50 million, you know, it's a real dicey kind of thing, because it means you don't have the as many of the big brands as far as actors go or directors. You don't have the big visual effects, but you do have a lot of risk, you know. And so, and if you make it really inexpensively, of course, you can still turn it around on some distribution and so on and so forth. But yeah, I think that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be very interesting. I know that from my viewing habits now, I mean, I think the number one thing that has, you know, while they're starting to write checks, and I think they have to write checks, the number one thing that's changed my viewing habits related to all this is Netflix. You know, Netflix streaming. You know, I just find myself much less, I'm so overwhelmed with so much content that I find myself much less interested in what's going out. And more importantly, I don't watch any ads. You know, I don't watch TV anymore. I don't know what's playing unless I check, and I don't even know anything about the movies anymore. So it's interesting. Speaking of TV though, speaking of whether it's relevant or not, Conan O'Brien returns to late night TV. He's back on TBS and he's swinging. I mean, he's been really, he's having a lot of fun using NBC as part of his comedic process, and so he's back. He's at 10 p.m. Central, which is a little bit of a complicated time. He's competing with a lot of other things. Brian, do you think that Conan's going to be successful? Is the late night format still a relevant format as we move into that next generation and that valuable 18 to 49 viewership?
Right. Well, that late night time slot, Jon Stewart in the Next Generation, Chelsea yeah. Handler's right. success at 11 p.m. Jon Stewart's found success at 11 p.m. I think Conan will find some success at 11. I think the metrics are going to be very different than they were on broadcast, and there's going to be an awkward period where we don't know how to judge Conan and how the show's doing. But I think he'll give Jon Stewart a run for his money at 11 o'clock.
So you think that the same viewers that are watching Jon Stewart are going to be likely to go over to Conan?
I think there's going to be a real competition for viewers at that time between Jon Stewart's audience. I think some of Jon Stewart's audience, yes, would gravitate toward Conan. I think he'll pick up viewers from all over the map, though. I think there's probably 20 cable channels where Conan will pick up a few viewers, you know what I mean, and then create a sort of audience for himself.
I mean, in some ways, like, I think I find myself, you know, Jon Stewart sometimes makes me think too hard. So I think Conan is a little easier. I have to think more about politics. I have to think more about stuff. It's not as relaxing when you're sitting around with your Manhattan or your martini
11,
or whatever.
At 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I just want to laugh. I don't want to laugh at. You know, I don't want to think about how stupid the government is or be tuned up or anything else. I just want to just think things are funny. So Lonnie,
you could make the case that Jon Stewart's gotten more and more serious over the years. I think I would probably make that case.
Oh, I think definitely. He is, and I think as he got more serious, I think the problem is that as he got more serious, I watched it less. You know, like there was
his viewership might also be aging as he does that. I mean, what struck right. me about the Rally for Sanity on the Mall were the number of 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds that I was interviewing. I interviewed right. hardly any. I mean, there were plenty of 20-year-olds, but there were just as many 50-year-olds, and yeah. it was a reflection that the Jon Stewart audience is not as young or not as unilaterally young as we think.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely an issue, and I find that I'm, as it got more serious and more political, you know, I just was, you know, I just kind of, because then you, I think what ends up happening is a lot of people don't agree with it, and then they just kind of, and it's not that I don't necessarily agree or disagree with Jon Stewart, it's just that it's like, oh, I just want to watch something and have fun, you know, so I go back to Netflix and watch an X-Files or something like that. So, Lon, what do you think? Is Conan going to make a go of it at TBS?
I think so. I mean, the audience is certainly smaller being cable, but nonetheless, you know, the internet is going to hopefully carry his show. In fact, on my Facebook, I had a friend ask out on her wall, you know, where can I download Conan's show? So,
right.
You know, I hope that TBS has a good method of measuring the success of the show, both in its air, you know, its Nielsen ratings, but also what it's getting viewed at online, because that's how I watch The Daily Show. I rarely sit down and watch a whole half hour of it. But I'll watch the clips that pop up on Comedy Central, I'd be shocked if they didn't do it.
Yeah, I think more and more The Daily Show is about those clips the next morning. You know, they sometimes will draw half a million. They'll sometimes draw half their television audience to their web clips. You know, they'll get right. half a million online. They get about a million on TV. And I think if anything, you're going to see that web rating for The Daily Show grow, even as the TV ratings may or may not slip.
Well, and that's
Conan, I think, is going to be a little. Conan, you might have people watching full episodes of Conan online. I think Conan probably presents itself less for the, you know, I'm going to go watch the first act of Conan on the web. I think people are more likely to watch the whole episode of Conan on the web. But TBS is going to stream it both on Hulu and on TBS.com. So they definitely recognize the value of the web for him.
Yeah, and I think that the what's interesting is when you look at The Daily Show again, when you look at anything, because they're building such, they're using their TV audience to build their online audience so effectively that the future of TV may affect TV, their network, but it doesn't affect the show as much. It doesn't affect the brand as much because it means that they, you know, that they're going to continue to build that audience. They're able to take advantage of that transition. If that makes sense. So, speaking of someone who's transitioning, The Gap turns to social media to draw shoppers. This is also from the Wall Street Journal. So here's what the Gap did. They gave away 10,000 pairs of jeans on Friday to people who checked in at the Gap using Facebook's new deals feature. So, so Facebook unveiled this program and basically provided merchants access to 200 million mobile phone users. The Gap, you know, jumped into it, and they had lines of 50 people, you know, in the San Francisco store where there were only 15 pairs of jeans to give away. But anyway, so the awkward. So yeah. So anyway, but they of course, if you got there otherwise, you still got 40% off. You know, earlier they had done a Groupon where they had This was in August. They gave away $50 worth of merchandise for $25, and hundreds of thousands of people bought the promotion. So here's the question: is how do other retailers, Lon? How do other retailers take advantage of this? Is this a model that can be reproduced?
Oh, hey! Anytime you give a discount for some kind of interaction, it's a no-brainer. And again, this also I think helps my theory of the two shows ago, where I said that whole logo thing was a setup, because they clearly have a strategy for social media at the Gap, and this logo thing was clearly part of that to get more attention back to the brand. And it's great, and I'm sure we'll see more people doing that. You've had the Foursquare check-in deal at Starbucks. If you become the mayor, you can get a buck off a cold drink or whatever. And I could see this definitely becoming something of interest, and it's also an advertising vehicle for them as well, because not only do you show up with a coupon, but you're also telling your friends that you're at the Gap getting this deal today, and it can actually help. It's even better than a coupon in many senses of the word, because there is a sharing of the deal.
Well, yeah. And here's the question is that when they did the Groupon deal, it temporarily brought Groupon's site down. I mean, people are really, really interested in this, and you know, that's been a problem. Groupon has been mostly the problem that Groupon has had, is that they, when local businesses provide these coupons, they get crushed, and they literally can't produce what they said they were going to do for that coupon because they have too many people react. Brian, the question for you is this coupon cutting, this digital coupon cutting, is this something that could supplant a lot of traditional advertising?
I can't imagine that it plays traditional advertising to a big extent. I think there's still a hugely small number of people that are checking into companies online. Mm-hmm. I don't see an enormous amount of evidence that that's growing. The people that do it, and like myself, certainly want to be exposed to these deals from companies. But I guess I'm skeptical that we see the hockey. We don't see the hockey stick growth yet. At least I don't see the hockey stick growth yet of checking into companies on your phone to support that.
I'm also cynical
because I've got all these Groupon coupons that I haven't printed out and actually used yet. So, you know, these companies have gotten my money without me taking advantage of the discount.
Well, here's the question, though. Is, for instance, if your phone had a 2D barcode, so you didn't have to print anything out, if you were able to just take it in, walk in, and use your phone to do that, would you be more likely to use the coupon?
I suppose I would be. I suppose I would be.
I mean, to me,
I haven't tried it yet personally, but it makes sense.
Also have, like, you know, because I saw, like, I was introduced to this. We were working in Phoenix, and one of the producers we were working with down there, restaurants.com is kind of like Groupon, but just for restaurants, where you can find all these but it's not just like one here and there. You can find all the restaurants in your area, and you can buy, you know, $25 for 10 or $5 for, you pay $5 and get $10, whatever it is, to get in there. And so the thing is that she said she buys all of her meals that way. I mean, anytime she's eating out, she just goes up there and signs up for all of this stuff. And it's just, it has completely changed the way that, you know, how she picks restaurants, you know, is based on, you know, because she saves a lot of money. And when you know what you're doing, and she said, yeah, sometimes you need a larger group, like, to go to restaurants.com. But what she does is she goes with a bunch of friends, and her piece of that puzzle is completely paid for, because she's got this coupon that reduces it by more than whatever she paid. It seems like it's a pretty heavy driver, but
that I would sign up for.
yeah, restaurant. Well, and the thing is, as I said, I think that the big missing piece is the Android and iPhone integration, where you're able to, there's no reason why you couldn't have an iPhone with a 2D barcode, where you can just kind of point it they can use their traditional laser scanner, or they'd have to have a 2D laser, you know, scanner that's able to handle it. But literally, they could have another iPhone that was able to do that, you know. So it'd be, anyway, interesting. We'll see how that goes. Now, Lon, before we go any further, Lon, you're going to have to tell us, you have to give us the whole breakdown on the NASA tweet up.
Yes. So I was really fortunate. I never win anything. And this wasn't really winning something, but you get picked out of a large group. But I got picked out of 3,000 people to be one of 150 to go to the space shuttle launch that unfortunately did not happen last week. But NASA's been doing this thing where they do go out on Twitter and pick people at random who sign up to experience NASA from the inside. And they take you around on VIP tours We got driven out to the launch pad a couple of times. So I got within probably about 600 yards of the space shuttle, so close that the tour driver told us that if it went off right while we were standing there, we'd probably all die from the sound of this thing going up. But it was such an amazing experience, and it's such an amazing program that they put together. And when you think about the cost to what you get out of it, you know, they put up a tent for us. They had some Wi-Fi available for us to tweet and upload photos and everything. And we had to pay our own way to get there. So this wasn't any kind of government handout or anything like that. But the NASA officials I spoke with said that the number of followers of this group was about 1.8 million just on Twitter alone. A large chunk of that was Jason Goldman from Twitter was there, so he was part of that big number. But nonetheless, about 500,000 people from the rest of us mortals that were there, and the communication is continuing throughout this week. You know, everyone's finally getting caught up with their pictures and videos and everything else, and we got taken into the vehicle assembly building. We got to meet astronauts in the flesh and ask them about what it was like to be an astronaut on the space shuttle. And it was really just an amazing experience to really get a feel for just how complicated space travel still is and how dangerous it is. In fact, the thing that scrubbed the launch was probably one of the most serious hydrogen leaks they've ever had on the pad. So it's a very complicated business. And for NASA right now, which is in a very, very precarious position, given that the project they were working on for the last 5 years has been pretty much upended by the administration, they're really in need of all the fan help that they can get the word out. And they're seeing a real value for doing the social media outreach. And I think it's a real lesson for other organizations that have a message to get out there that, you know, you just have to invite a couple hundred of your best and most able fans to help carry your message forward. And we're more than happy to do it. but it was really something.
I'm such a huge, I mean, my mom used to let me, I so wanted to go. Like when you were talking about it, I was like, oh my gosh, I really should be there. You know, because the, you know, when the space shuttle, started, my mother used to let me take the day off every time the space shuttle launched, and I would sit there and watch it, you know, cause I was so into the space program and I was so into the design and everything else. And I was just obsessed with, you know, with the space program. And so, and I suddenly realized, oh my gosh, this is the end of an era, you know, and still at this age, I'm still like, there's a lot of government programs that I'm not that excited about. You know, I mean, I don't know. I think we spend, you know, I don't know if we spend too much on defense. I'm not sure about Medicare. I'm not sure about Social Security. like those things, I'm kind of like, man, I don't know if I really want my tax dollars going to any of those things. But yeah, NASA, I don't have any problem with. You can spend as much money as you want.
So I'll tell you what, if it did launch, we were going to watch it from the press area, which is actually the best possible, closest possible place to see the launch. So to
without being incinerated?
Yeah, without being incinerated or killed. In fact, it's not a breathing soul within 3 miles of the spaceship before it goes up. But when you walk out onto the lawn, you see the clock. And that's the same clock that people watched, billions of people watched. It's probably the most viewed timepiece in the world before the Apollo missions and the Mercury and Gemini missions before them. You're seeing that. And then you're looking out across this turning basin, just a little body of water. And there's the space shuttle on the launch pad, and you can see it. Yeah. And it's the one thing that I'm hoping they're going to try to get us to come back, actually, if it goes up on the 30th, which is the new launch date, at about 3:30 in the morning. But I don't care. I'm going to find a way to get down there and see this thing kills me.
Well, so, let us know, because we'd love to see more. So we should, really, you know, if you go down again, let us know. We'll send you down with a live U-Box. Are you allowed to stream from there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they encourage it, actually. And I did a quick little stream to Dane Golden when everything was canceled, unfortunately. But they definitely... they definitely want that, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, great. We'll have you maybe stream some of the touring and some of the other stuff too.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. Next story, Hulu Plus is now available to everyone. It's passed its beta stage, and now this is according to PC World, of course. Peter Smith was talking about it, and he said, you know, it's not all the contents on there that you'd expect on, you know, that you have on Hulu. You know, it's back and forth. He wasn't so sure if it was valuable enough. Brian, is Hulu Plus is this going to be a turn? Is this going to work? Are they still in the curve? Are they still in the game?
You know, I'm surprised that the full launch of Hulu Plus did not get more attention, and you know, maybe that's partly my fault and other reporters' faults. But we made
so much
up. I think
it's all your fault. We don't know about what's going on.
We made so much a big deal out of the announcement that it existed, and that was back when nobody could actually get it. I think some of this also comes down to the reports from All Things D and elsewhere that there's some internal debate about the price, that maybe the price is too high, maybe it should be $5 a month instead of $10 a month. Now, personally, I've had it since the summer. I'm paying $10 a month without even realizing it. It's one of those things like Netflix that just gets sucked out of your bank account and you don't think about it. And I'm very happy with it. I've said to people, I'll probably have Hulu Plus for the rest of my life, assuming they don't get rid of it, because it's such a convenient way for me to watch more TV than I otherwise would. But I don't know if I'm a niche market or not, and I'm afraid that I am.
Well, I think as we look at stuff like the Roku, the TVs that are now incorporating all of this stuff into it, I think that that's where it makes the most sense, is because the problem for me is that if I have to get another box to do it, it's really difficult for me to think about doing that. But if it's just simply, if I'm opening up my Roku and I can choose between Netflix and Hulu, it seems to be much more viable, you know, me trying to find what I'm looking for. Lon, is this something that you think are you interested in getting Hulu Plus?
Well, at $5 a month, I might do it. The other one was... the other price, I forgot whatever it was. It just seemed a bit high for me, especially given that you're still getting interrupted with ads along the way. So I think if the price gets adjusted a little bit, if there is an ad-free version, it looks like they're talking about like a $13 ad-free subscription, maybe. But I generally have a DVR now at home, so I'd be less eager to jump on this right away. But yeah, something I would consider if it had some really good back catalog stuff or something like that.
I mean, I'm just getting new broadband for my kids. My older kids that live in outside of Pittsburgh, they're moving to Freeport, Pennsylvania. Get this, Freeport, Pennsylvania, a fiber connection, 15 megabit down, 2 megabit up. So it's not crazy fast, but it's fast for $45 a month, flat. Hmm. Flat, you know, go ahead.
Is there usage restrictions on like other? No, really. Okay.
No, it's a local Salzgiver. They're friends. It's an old classmate of mine. I'm not getting a special deal. He's an old classmate of mine that started this, and it's an ISP. He's been there for 20 years or whatever. So, but the ISP is, you know, they started doing fiber. So if you're in the town of Freeport, Pennsylvania, you can get this fiber connection. There's no restrictions. It's 15 megabits down, 2 megabits up, and they're not getting a phone. They're not getting cable. You know what they are going to, they already have Netflix. They're going to get probably Hulu Plus. And so that they're now paying for a little bit more than basic cable in San Francisco. And, but they're getting all of the stuff and it's all, you know, it's what they want. And they're completely off the grid, you know, I mean, from the phone and cable TV. And I think that as we start seeing these really fast connections, that's going to be more of an issue. And that relates a little bit to, of course, what was on GigaOm. This was, something that Dish Network VP of Online Content Development and Strategy, Bruce Eisen, said that if you can watch Glee tomorrow morning and I don't have to pay for TV service, you know, he said, I think that's bad. This was in the Streaming Media West conference. He said things, model sites like Hulu, where people can watch it whenever they want, they're killing TV. You know, they're making it very, you know, people are, and I have to admit, my issue is that when I look at all of this, I don't know what network most of the shows are on. Like, I really like Hawaii 5-0, but I don't know what network that's part of. I don't even know what time it shows up on the air. I just keep on going to Comcast until it shows up on the, like, I just browse through, then I just wait until it shows up and, oh, it's here. And then I watch it. And it's got only one commercial and it's a good show. Brian, do you think is Hulu and sites like this killing TV?
I think Hulu is TV.
Very good.
I think, look, Hulu will not be allowed to do too much damage to the existing business model of TV, because the owners of Hulu are the, you know, ones that are invested in the existing business model. You know what I mean? NBC, CBS, sorry, not CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox. They're not going to allow Hulu to do too much damage to their existing business models. And an example of that, a somewhat different example, is the hot show of the month, AMC's The Walking Dead. AMC put the first episode of The Walking Dead on Hulu for free so you could watch it. They wanted to sample it, but they won't put any more episodes on Hulu. They're going to make you either watch on TV or wait a few days for VOD on your cable box with ads, or pay $3 an episode on iTunes for it. I went the iTunes option because I didn't want to wait more than a day for VOD to come through. But I think, you know, we're going to have lots of shows like that. The big tentpole critically acclaimed shows of the future are going to be the ones that have restrictions on them on the web, so it gets harder to watch them without either ponying up money on iTunes or, you know, watching through your cable provider. I think that's a natural shakeout of the industry that's starting to happen.
Well, I mean, the question is with all this content available, with Netflix especially, I think Netflix, if you're going to talk about something that's killing the TV industry, and I'm not, you know, I shouldn't say
Netflix
this on a show.
Can't kill the TV industry.
You said what?
You think Netflix can kill the TV industry?
No,
how could it?
Here's why. Is because I have 400 things in my Netflix now. I mean, I have this huge list of stuff for my kids and stuff for me and stuff for my wife. And so I've got all this stuff on there. And because I have so much content available, when I'm browsing to watch something, I don't browse on TV anymore. I just browse in Netflix. Oh, what am I going to watch? I'm going to watch something else. And the reason I have so many is I have a bad habit of, like, when I think about that, sometimes I'm on my laptop, I sit there and go through and I add some more things to it. I see what's new on Netflix. And the issue is that I'm finding, because I have so much content available, I am very insensitive to the amount of time it takes for something to come out. So I find that even with Hawaii Five-0, which is my current thing that I really enjoy, I find it very aggravating that I have to wait another week, you know, to watch another one. And so what I've kind of gotten into now is, you know, I've stopped watching it so that it can stack up. And then I can watch it for a week, and then I'll stop watching it again. And like with 24, I got to a point where I wouldn't even think about it until the entire season was done and it was up online, so that I could just watch them as fast as I wanted to, two or three at a time or one at a time or whatever. I don't want to watch. And the reason I can do that is because I'm not going up there every day. I'm no longer hungry. And I think that this is, to me, this has been one of the bigger issues with the music industry that I don't think that they're really seeing. It's not piracy necessarily. It's not all those other things. It's that I have a Walkman. I mean, I have a, you know, an iPod that has every song I own on it. And so the thing is, and then if I don't have it there, I have it on a Zune that I have everything on it. And it really takes all of the pressure from me out of actually buying any more stuff. And so I'd really wait until I really like something. I really have to have it because I don't feel the need anymore. And I think that casual browsing is just gone for me. I mean, I don't do that on TV anymore. Lon, do you think that that these online things are going to put much more pressure? Do you think that's going to affect the industry?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's going to affect the local affiliates certainly more perhaps than the networks, because the affiliates are often running local advertising, as we just had to endure a whole political season of ads. That's where their money's made, is on these local ads that come through on these network shows. And there are some things going on that allow the affiliates to gain some local ad revenue through Hulu and ABC's app as well. But that, I think, is a bigger risk. But
I don't watch any local TV.
I don't either. I mean, I rarely watch television now that's not something I've downloaded or streamed somewhere else. You know, my news is all now written things that I'm reading, which has been great for me. I get more context than I've had before. And we're, of course, we're doing our own local video news online, which has been pretty successful from a viewership standpoint, too. So a lot of things are shifting, and consumers are going to drive this as much as they have the music industry into forcing them to deliver things in a format that they want to consume it in. And it's interesting to see the industry experimenting with Hulu, and this might be something that kind of gets out of their control, because if they take it away right now, it's going to be bad for them. So
I have to be the old-fashioned one here, though. I have to be the one that says Americans still watching 5 hours of old-fashioned TV every day. So I think that over time we're going to have a little bit of the experience on the television set of casual sort of browsing. But it's going to take a long time, I think, for that to
happen. I completely agree with you. When I say that, is this going to affect the industry? I'm usually thinking in a 5 to 10 year
10,
curve.
20. Okay.
You know, I'm not saying, is this going to happen next week? I mean, there's a huge difference between the coasts and the center of the country. Politically, you know, viewership wise, everything. So what we do is definitely, but I do think that there's a lot of things that we got excited about early, and we're now seeing those, you know, fleshing out further and further and more into the country. Now, here's the last, I'm going to end this, this episode, with one more story. And this is the one that, you know, that I've been really tracking a lot all over the United States. And this is happening in, Wilson, North Carolina. So the city has settled a year long battle with the area's local cable telco, Time Warner. The issue is that basically Wilson is building a 100 megabit municipal connection. So they're really giving people now, you know, Time Warner's quote unquote blazing speeds is 15 megabits a second. And this is a city that's offering as much as 100 megabits. And the more typical one goes up to 20 megabits. And so basically Time Warner has, you know, they sued them. They tried to stop him. We're seeing this all over the United States where the local cable operators are viciously fighting any attempt by municipalities to build their own system. And here's the problem. And here's why I want to know from you guys, but I'll just want to say my two cents about this. The number one way something that's not New York, not San Francisco, if you're a small town, number one way to build your economy, number one way to push it down is to get on the information, you know, superhighway, so to speak. You know, this is the future, whether it's media production or IT. And the number one way to get that built up is to actually, you know, have fast internet connections. And that is going to be almost impossible with these current providers because it's a hodgepodge of stuff. This needs to be your connection. We're now moving past this idea that it's a profit, whatever. I mean, it needs to be a utility. And if you don't look at it like a utility, you know, the United States is going to fall further and further behind. I am looking at, we've been working with the Rwandan government. They're putting fiber into, they're going to have WiMAX. Everybody's going to be connected. Everyone's going to have a faster connection than most Americans in the middle of Africa. The United States is about to fall woefully behind in this. And municipalities, it either needs to be a utility or municipalities have to be allowed to do this, in my opinion. Brian, what do you think about this whole process?
This is something I'd like to write about, so I'm going to try not to go too far out on a limb with my opinion on it. But I think there is I think you're right that there's a big story here that's happening across the country. And it is, given that what we've seen both in cable television and in internet, the idea of monopolies in local markets controlling that experience, there has to be, as we've seen with this city this time and as many others like it, there have to be more attempts to break open that monopoly structure. I'm sure it will cause lawsuits every time, right? Because they're going to try to protect their monopolies just like they are on TV. But it makes sense that we're not going to have as fast internet from the monopolies as we are from the municipalities or other competitors.
I mean, and here's a question. Lon, should we just start telling cable, just like electricity, just like the water, that from now, you know, we're going to start creating utilities out of them, and they're no longer going to be these fast growth or speculative markets, and they're going to become something that's kind of a blue chip. This is what you do. Is that the future? If the cities can't do it, is that the direction we should go?
I mean, it could. In Connecticut, you know, they are to some degree regulated as a utility because they are providing wires on a pole. But you know, where I live in this small town of mine, that we don't have any utilities that are publicly managed. So we'd have no sewer. We have no city water. We have to pay somebody to pick our garbage up. And so it may vary based on where these municipalities are and what stomach the taxpayers have for financing this sort of thing. Our taxes our property taxes here in my town of Essex are significantly lower than other tax rates in other parts of the state because we have no services really beyond a public school, snow plows, and a few other things.
But creating a utility is not the government spending money on this necessarily. It says, okay, you're a monopoly. Mm-hmm. We're going to give you that.
Yep.
But now
right.
We're going to regulate you. We're going to regulate you heavily.
Mm-hmm. And here in Connecticut, there is some regulation of the wire itself and how it comes to us.
Right.
They don't regulate the speed of the connection. There's very little enforcement of the actual speed of the connection, which I think is a big problem. Comcast, believe it or not, here is actually really good, like really fast. I'm on it right now. I'm able to do this show and other things as well, much faster than our phone company offers. And we do have some choice here. So Comcast has been upping my speeds here probably about every other year. Substantially too, and I'm paying exactly what I paid 10 years ago, and I have a connection now that's 20 times faster. I think it's going to vary market to market. I do feel that municipalities, if the taxpayers of those communities or their elected officials feel that that's an important thing for those towns to do, then they should have the right to do that and not have to go fight a company for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if the towns vote for it, if the towns say, mm-hmm. if the town of Wilson says, hey, we want to spend our taxpayer money or we want to apply for things and we want to do it, it seems like it should be something that they
absolutely
have the right
totally.
To do. And
totally.
As I said, I mean, when you look at a company like when you look at a state like Kansas or Iowa or whatever, they have low cost of living. They have all kinds of opportunities. And I mean, as far from a, you know, you can buy a house for $80,000 that's really nice. But, right. you know, and so if you add a high 100 megabit connection to that, now there's all kinds of businesses that they can do there. And as we look at GoToMeeting, as we look at these other, you know, all these other things where we can meet with people, we can collaborate with people, we can have Skype, we can do all these other things. You know, it gets to a point where we just don't need to be in any certain place, and it's a huge empowerment for these for these areas to have high speed, ubiquitous access. And when you look at it, also when you look at the ability to have wireless everywhere, so you have WiMAX or Wi-Fi. I mean, the city of, as I said, I'm most familiar with this right now, but the city of Kigali has WiMAX in the entire. This is in Rwanda, has WiMAX that runs through the entire capital. It's one system, one. Piece, one modem works all over the entire city. You don't drop out. You don't do anything. You just move around, and you have fiber going into that in January. And so the thing is that when you have that kind of centralized access, it provides a lot of opportunity for remote locations to jump onto this. You know, this still growing industry where a lot of the other industries, if you look at Michigan or you look at the other places where a lot of the other industries are contracting. It's important for these organizations to do that today, to do that now, not to do it 10 years from now when we finally get through all of that. Brian, right. Last word is yours. Anything else to add?
Like I said, I'm going to try not to go out on a limb.
He's like,
I'm very jealous of Rwanda right now.
Oh my gosh, you're gonna have to come and you're gonna have to come to Rwanda when we get our little facility set up there.
So. There's nothing that hits at home better than that comparison between what we experience here and over there with the WiMAX.
Yeah. So anyway, it's pretty slick. Anyway, Brian, where can people find you?
Brian Stelter. Actually, you know, my website's down right now. So twitter.com/Brian Stelter. Got to get that website back up.
And definitely, if you're listening, you should definitely follow both Brian and Lon. I you know, that's how I find out whatever Brian's working on, is I just watch his Twitter go by. So it's very good. And Lon, where Thanks. Can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter as well, LonSeidman, and I'll be posting more photos and videos of my NASA tweet-up experience later this week, including a robot that will be attached to the side of the space station, which is pretty cool. So nice. Lots of cool stuff.
Awesome. This is Alex Lindsay, and this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out. This Week in Media is a PixelCore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jaminkar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.